This is episode 6 of the Nothing Human podcast, Three Powers of the Human Spirit, part 6, On the Will.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.
Welcome to the Nothing Human podcast, a biblically informed think space for exploring and articulating all the ways we make or break sense of human experience. I'm your host, Michael Minkoff. From my youngest days, I have been fascinated with categories of thought, those often unconscious filing mechanisms that invisibly populate our premises, direct our inquiries, and ordain our conclusions. Join me as we investigate and interrogate our assumptions in an effort to articulate a more cohesive understanding of human information within the superstructure of God's truth. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Nothing Human podcast. We're going to talk about the will today. Last week, we talked about the affections, and I'll probably be doing a bonus episode, maybe after the series, on addressing disorders within the affections a little bit more. I don't have a whole lot more to add, but it might be worth an additional short discussion. Thank you very much for everybody who has commented and asked questions on my website and elsewhere. I really do appreciate your engagement, and if you would, do me a favor. If this podcast means something to you, if you would go on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify and follow me and rate the podcast and maybe even leave a review, that would be really helpful. That will help to get the podcast in front of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to find it, and that would be really helpful to me. And so if this is something valuable to you, it probably would be valuable maybe to other people. If you can just do me that favor, I would really appreciate it. All right, let's get into it today, talking about the will. First off, I want to have a little bit of a thought experiment having to do with Star Wars. So in the Star Wars universe, you have the moral framework of light and dark. And if you think about the light side versus the dark side, they basically are material categories that are within the realm of that particular cosmos or galaxy or whatever. It's a galaxy far, far away, you know. Anyway, but within this idea of the light and the light and the dark have sort of a yin-yang type idea, very Eastern mystic. But in that idea, that which leads to death and passion and selfishness is dark. And that which leads to life and good and all these kinds of things are light. So physical, material, cosmic categories. The problem with this framework is that it is actually incoherent, and even within the narrative of Star Wars, the idea of light and dark really breaks down. Let me give you an example. So Darth Vader, who, you know, he's the dark side master and the betrayer of all things that are good and whatnot. And in A New Hope, in typically dark side fashion, Darth Vader strikes down Obi-Wan Kenobi, killing him, and everyone boos because it's horrible. But then fast forward past the character redemption arc of Darth Vader, and in Return of the Jedi, Darth Vader kills the Emperor by throwing him down a mineshaft, purportedly kills, we find out later, whatever, doesn't matter. Anyway, so this is presumably also dark side, because the dark side is what leads to death and passion and anger, and it seems like the same Darth Vader who kills Obi-Wan, the same guy kills in Return of the Jedi. Is that a light side or a dark side action? Well, obviously it has to be dark side. Dark side is leading to death and killing. So why is one booed at and the other cheered? And you could ask the same question concerning the destruction of Alderaan, where we all boo because the Empire is destroying Alderaan and all the lives that are on there. And Obi-Wan talks about how, you know, he felt a disturbance of the Force as if, you know, millions of organisms had their lives suddenly cut off. So he feels that. But then we all cheer when the Death Star is destroyed, even though there's probably a few thousand at least workers on there and lives are lost in the destruction of the Death Star. And yet we cheer when that happens. We boo when Alderaan is blown up. Really, what is the difference within the framework of light and dark? You actually need a moral framework that transcends light and dark, that transcends good and evil. And that's what we're going to get into today. So this is one of the most major preliminary issues that we have to discuss when we're discussing the will, because if the goal of the will is righteousness, we really need to define what righteousness actually means. And there's some confusion over this because they have collapsed the distinction of good and evil from the distinction of righteousness and wickedness. And we need to redistinguish those things in order to have a more clear view of what righteousness actually is for the will. So good and evil in the scriptures, especially in the Old Testament, but even in the New Testament, are talked about in more visible material terms, creational terms, whereas right and wrong are more heavenly terms, and right and wrong actually has to do with the distribution of the material good and material evil that's in the universe. And that may not make sense to you right off the bat, so I'll just give you some definitions. And then I'll explain why these are really important, especially when it comes to the will and our standard of righteousness. Good is that which tends toward life. So evil is that which tends toward death. So all the things that tend toward life, this would include pleasure, blessing, material goods. And evil, on the other hand, is everything which tends toward death, which would be pain, displeasure, the deprivation of a good. Any of those things could be called evils. And so when you think about these things, these are material creational categories, and they are actually distinguished not by the will, but by the affections, meaning the affections are the power that determines good and evil for a particular person. The will is responsible for determining right and wrong, righteousness or unrighteousness, and this is a separate category. Righteousness is that which accords with the will and character of God, whether good or evil. Wickedness is that which contradicts the character of God or the decrees of God, whether good or evil. Now, the reason I say whether good or evil is because there are evils that are permissible, and that are righteous even, and there are goods that are permissible and that are righteous. There are also goods that are impermissible and therefore wicked, and there are also evils that are impermissible and therefore wicked. When you collapse these distinctions on top of themselves, you end up with an improper distinction between the domain of the affections, good and evil, and the domain of the will, righteousness and wickedness. And one of the reasons why this is very important is because we've already talked about the standard of righteousness has to locate itself in the heavenly reality of God's righteousness. And so what you're seeking with your will in a properly ordered will, the goal of it is the righteousness of God. Well, if God is righteous, the question would be, is God good? Yes. Does God only do good? That's a different question. So I'm going to point out a few biblical verses that, again, because of our definitions, have been translated in such a way that it might be hard to see what I'm getting at, but I'll quote from it, and then we'll talk about the Hebrew terms behind this. In Isaiah 45, verse 7, God is speaking, and he says, I am Yahweh, and there is no other, the one forming light and creating darkness, causing good and creating evil. I am Yahweh who does all these. Then you see the same idea in Lamentations 3, verses 37 and 38. Where it says, who is there who speaks and it comes to pass, unless the Lord has commanded it? Is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both good and evil go forth? Now, if you are saying that good and evil are moral categories, these verses are very troublesome. And that's why in most of your translations, if you look them up, you'll see that evil has been translated calamity or ill or harm or something like that to avoid the contrast that's really being made here, which is that God is the source of material good, and he is also the causative source of material evil. Now, the problem with conflating or collapsing the distinction between good and evil and righteousness and wickedness, is that then you would have to say that any evil that God does or that God creates or that goes forth from his mouth is also wickedness. Meaning for God to do evil, he would also have to be wicked. And we don't believe that, which means that it's possible to do evil in a righteous way, which means that you have to come up with a standard beyond good and evil for what is right and wrong, which means that the standard for the righteousness of the will has to be beyond good and evil. This is extremely important. If you think about law in these terms, what you come to recognize is that law, any law, is the distribution of permissible goods and evils. It is impossible to avoid this unless you're basically going to devolve into might makes right. If there is not a law that governs what choices are permissible between good and evil by a particular will, then the only law there is that that will can do whatever it can get away with, which means that ultimately might would make right, which is what the Star Wars universe actually does devolve into, that whatever you can do, that no one can stop you from doing, is ultimately right for you. And there isn't any rule in good and evil itself that is beyond that. And you might say, well, I can see that the law does distribute good or preserve good for certain parties versus others. I mean, think about the law, you shall not steal. The law means that there is property, so somebody has something, and it is theirs, and you may not have that good, whether it is a piece of bread or whether it's their house or their car. You may not just take that good. That good is not permitted to you. That good is permitted to the person who has rightful property ownership over that good. And you could say, in a sense, that that is a distribution both of good and of evil, in the sense that you are not permitted to take that good from that person who owns it. On the other hand, there are people who are permitted to take that good, meaning they are permitted to do that evil. For instance, in the case of a civil asset forfeiture, the police are authorized to take certain parts of your private property away from you if they're being used in the commission of a crime. Now, we can argue about whether or not that is right and wrong in God's eyes, but in terms of a law, that is a distribution of evil. The police have the right to do that evil. Not just any guy walking down the street has that same distribution of evil. And you can see that that's the case with all law. I mean, you can look at all law in these terms as a distribution of goods and evils, and basically a set of permissions concerning goods and evils. And that means that if you're thinking about the standard of righteousness, which is in God, the question becomes, what is God not permitted to do? What evil is not permitted to God? What good is not permitted to God? And the answer is there isn't any, because he is the standard of righteousness. Now, that doesn't mean he isn't good. It's just that to say that God is righteous is a different thing than to say that God is good. It's the affections that assess the goodness of God. It is the will that recognizes and seeks after the righteousness of God. Again, these overlap very, very much, but they're still distinct, and it's important to understand that they are distinct. So even when we're talking about the evil that God does, we can say that because God is good and not evil, meaning he is good, he is love, we can say that any short-term evil that God is involved in is not ultimately for the goal of evil. So there is a disorder of the will that's talked about in the Old Testament that's called the way of evil. And you can see the evil doer. That's still talking about material terms. There is a way of evil, meaning that there are those people who love destruction, who love harm, who love doing harmful things to others. And those people are wicked, because it is wrong to love evil. But it is not, when they're saying this is an evil person or this is an evil doer, that is meant in material terms, meaning they do evil to others. They harm other people. The issue with those evil people is most of the time, because their love is for the evil, they end up doing the evil even when it's not permitted to them. And this is a very important distinction, it's massively important on all sorts of different things, and I'm going to have to let you think through it a little bit. But if you're looking for some other implications of this distinction, and it is a categorical distinction, I think, to be fundamental to issues of the will, I have an article that I wrote called The Problem of Evil Has an Evil Problem, and it's on my website, and you can check it out and you can read through it. And at some point, maybe I can do an episode on this specifically. But for the time being, I will say that the will's purpose is to distribute good and evil. And that's a very, very important idea. It's wrong for the will to distribute good and evil to itself or to others in a way that is impermissible to a lawful order, either from God or a proper authority. So after getting that out of the way, talking about the goal of the will is righteousness, it is the righteousness of God. The idea of righteousness has to do with the distribution of goods and evils, meaning the permissible distribution of goods and evils to whom, in what measure, in what context. And what's interesting about that, when you begin to think about it, because of the fact that it has to do with choices made concerning material realities, through material realities, in fact, the will might be more connected to the body than any other power, including the affections. And even though the affections has gotten a really bad rap, because it does oftentimes give you some indication of the sense of the body, right? What the body feels. The body says, this is good, this is bad, this hurts, this feels good. But it's the will that manages those things and distributes those things. Again, it's through the will that you say to the body, you must experience this evil for this period of time in order to achieve this long-term good, or you must have this good for this period of time in order to achieve this other goal. It ultimately is the will that controls the body, that governs the body, and in that sense, governs even what the affections are allowed to have of the things that they want. And in that sense, if you were to put each of the powers into an organ or something like that, you oftentimes will talk about the head being the place where the intellect is, the heart being the place where the emotions are, and the hand being connected to the will, or the body, even the body directly as being connected to the will. So the will is, in many ways, the most body-oriented of the powers, because the will concerns choices, deeds done in the body. As you can see in 2 Corinthians 5:10, this is actually, it says we're going to stand before the judgment seat of God, and we will be judged for the deeds done in the body, whether good or evil. That is interesting, given the fact that you would think if the judgment were concerning righteousness, that it would just be a spiritual judgment. But apparently, since the will and what we do is actually acted out in evidence in the body, in some ways, that is the only standard and the only evidence that Jesus needs in order to make a judgment. What have you done? And because of that, there are certain dividing scenarios. Consider how he will actually judge. So we're told in 2 Corinthians that Jesus will judge the deeds done in the body. So how will he? What deeds will he pick to determine, you know, what have you willed and what have you done? What have you accomplished in this? And Jesus uses what I call dividing scenarios. These are scenarios where a righteous person will operate one way and an unrighteous person will operate in a different way. Now, there are lots of scenarios where righteous and unrighteous people operate exactly the same way. For instance, most people will treat nice people nicely, but if somebody's mean to you, how do you respond then? Do you bless your enemies? Do you bless those who curse you? That's a weird behavior. Most people render evil when they are treated with evil. They repay evil with evil. When a person does not repay evil with evil, that's a kind of, you know, your ears prick up and you go, that's weird. That's an abnormal circumstance. Why is that person doing that? And so there are various different dividing scenarios. You can see in Jesus's case that he says that the way that you treat the quote unquote least of these, you have done unto me. And so the judgment of the will in terms of how the will operates in accordance with righteousness is, if I'm going to put it in my own terms, how have you treated those people who cannot harm you or help you in your perception? Now, again, your perception could be wrong. They might be able to harm or hurt you a lot more than you thought. Like, for instance, when the king dresses up as a beggar, that's part of the point there, as he's going throughout the kingdom and saying, how do people treat beggars? How would people treat me if I was stripped of all of my capacity to harm or help them? Would they still be good to me? And usually he finds out most people are not good to him. And then occasionally there's these real diamonds among his citizenry who treat him well, even though he is a beggar. And he knows then, hey, the way you've treated the least of these, that's the way you've actually treated me. And that's that fable or that parable is a way of making that literal. But the reality is still there, that that's a dividing scenario. That's how you really determine the character of a person's will, what choices they choose to make, even when they are not benefited or when they're not afraid of harm. Again, notice this. If we are seeking after the righteousness of God and we are attempting to move our will all the way there, then we need a law that is better than just the distribution of goods and evils that we have worked out for ourselves to the best of our ability. Because think, that doesn't actually go beyond the body at all. Think about this for a second. The body on its own terms is tuned to survival. So its inherent morality cannot transcend good and evil. So if we know that righteousness does in fact transcend good and evil, meaning there is sometimes that harm to yourself or others is necessary for righteousness, and there are some times when good for another or the deprivation of your own good is necessary for righteousness, right? When you're thinking about these things, that righteousness has to be a standard of the distribution of goods and evils, which means it has to be beyond good and evil. If that's necessary, that means that the best morality that you could get from just your own body, which only knows harms and pleasures, is not going to be real righteousness. It will only try to avoid harm and death and pursue pleasure and subsistence. And so a law is necessary to manage the distribution of harm and subsistence between even two people, because when you have even just two people, the good of one person is no longer an adequate rule for determining the proper distribution of goods and evils. But even if you just have one person, that person's limited understanding of good and evil isn't good enough for just them. Even for just that one person, it's not good enough, meaning it is not going to get them all the way to righteousness. It's not even going to produce the best and most desirable good unless the scope of that good starts to become so universal that it starts to look the same as the standard of righteousness. This is important. So if God is good and God is righteous, then you have that same idea of the categorical imperative that we talked about in episode 3, this idea that if it's good for all time and it's good for all space, you've gotten close to being an ultimate objective, you know, not just good for now, not just good for me now, but good for everybody for all time, good for the cosmos for all time. You're starting to get to a more ultimate standard for both good and righteousness. Once you start getting to that more ultimate standard, what's interesting is that they start to converge. At the point of God, even though there's still a distinction, there is no separation between God's righteousness and God's goodness. At the point of absoluteness, meaning you've reached the infinite scale of all time and all cosmos, at that scale, good and righteousness are not different. The conflict between good and righteousness occurs in time, in finiteness. And that's why it's a constant struggle, and you can see that it is a constant struggle, between your affections and your will. Because your affections are telling your will, here's what's good, here's what's evil. The will is supposed to be appealing to a higher standard than just what is good for me now. And if you do not have a higher standard than what is good for me now, then you are on the way of evil. You are on the way of evil. All you have is the fleshly instinct towards survival, which will throw every single other person under the bus if necessary in order to achieve better good for you right now and avoid harm right now, which means you're never going to treat the least of these with any degree of care because they can't harm you, and so who cares? And they can't help you, and so who cares? You can see how that is fleshly mindedness. Fleshly mindedness happens, or fleshliness in the scriptural terms of Sarks. This happens, dead meatness happens, when the will is no larger than the body. And obviously, this is not adequate for righteousness. The will has to supersede, has to in some sense be beyond the body in order to be righteous. And even the affections have to be beyond the body, seek for something beyond the body in order to truly be good and to truly embrace life. It's very interesting, the interaction that you probably already detect between the will and the affections, that if the will is the distribution of good and evil, and the affections are our sense of good and evil, then very often the will and the affections are related to one another. And this interaction is made really clear in the Greek word thelema, which means desire or will or wish. And it can sometimes mean what you attempt to do or intend with your actions, like what you will or what you intend. But it can other times mean what you desire, meaning you desire for it to happen, but you're not going to will or attempt to do it. So you can see this in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, where it says, this is good, and again, probably materially good, and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth. A lot of people have had a lot of questions about this, because if right there, the word thelo is supposed to refer to desire, then does God have desires that he doesn't fulfill? And if it's will, does God ever will something that doesn't come to pass? And I think you're going to have to read it in those first terms, that God has desires, affectional desires, that are sometimes not accomplished by his will. I mean, again, I don't want to step on any toes and I don't want to get too crazy here, but I think that the idea that a person could have a desire that he does not fulfill and that still be righteous and actually still be complete, I think makes a lot of sense. I mean, even Jesus, who we believe never sinned, said, not my will, but your will be done, meaning that Jesus had desires that, I guess, were separate from, contrary to some degree or another, the will of his Father. And rather than fulfilling those desires, he instead willed to do what the Father intended for him to do. So it's important to understand there's this weird intersection there between your affections, what you desire, what you feel like, and your will, which makes the choice in the end. And the will has a certain kind of will. We talk about, is it your will that this should be done? And things like that. Could you say the same, like, is it your desire that that should be done? Is a person's will and their desire kind of interconnected? Yeah, in some ways, interchangeably. And so the will and the affections are clearly very joined together, but they have to be distinguished in the sense that the will accomplishes its purposes and makes the choice. The affections are much more of a sense, and they can express a desire and they can express a status of your love or your hate or these kinds of things, but they don't necessarily make the choice. They never make the choice. The will makes the choice. And because the will makes the choice, the will is very, very much connected to the self, self-image. I mean, we know that you are judged by what you do before Jesus. And so is that where your identity is? It is either in what you desire or in what you will. Let's talk about this. Let's talk about the self. Where is your identity actually stored? Is your identity in one of the three powers? I would say if you were going to locate it in one power more so than the others, you would have to say that your identity is stored in the will before it's stored in the others. You might say what you love or what you desire is more, quote unquote, who you are. But again, you can't really disconnect that from what you will, because again, you're willing according to desires, but sometimes in contradiction to those desires. So I would say it's definitely some kind of a combination or interconnection of the affections and the will where your identity actually resides. Meaning, who are you? You're some combination of what you love and what you do. And the intellect is actually what stores that information. It sees and names it. Here's what you are, based on what you love and what you do. But the identity itself, you could say, is produced by the interaction of desires, intentions, and choices. These three could be considered entirely within the will, actually. And so I would say the will is probably the front runner for what is your identity. This makes a lot of sense because the will is regularly connected to the soul, which is regularly connected to your spiritual identity. And again, because the soul oftentimes is what's responsible for choices that are being made, and the soul is also interacting with the affections in the sense of those choices are being made according to certain desires or against those certain desires. But I would say in general that if you wanted to know what a person's identity was, you could orient that around their will. That is, in some ways, the best picture of who they are, because the will contains the desires and it also contains the choices. Because it involves both desires and choices, what you love and what you do, it's probably the clearest picture of all the powers of who you really are in the state that you're currently in. Let's talk a little bit about disorders of the will, and we'll go through these. When we talk about disorders of the will, we would talk about these in the same terms that we talk about disorders of any of the powers, in terms of the goal, the standard, or the function. So if the goal is righteousness, and particularly the righteousness of God, then there would be a disorder in the goal if some other righteousness were actually what you were pursuing. And there are a lot of options for righteousnesses out there that you might actually be pursuing as your goal, and that would constitute a disorder of the will. You might say, well, if the will is all about doing the right thing, then, you know, most people are going to be real rule-following, etc. But we already talked about how internal will-oriented people are not very rule-following, and they still are pursuing a sense of righteousness. It's just that the standard for that righteousness is developed within themselves and might even be themselves if their wills are disordered. And many times, even rule-following people, their standard for righteousness is still themselves, in the sense of what they're seeking is not necessarily approval with God or the righteousness of God. They're seeking approval with human beings, you know, people-pleasing and the favor of humankind, which we see with the Pharisees in the New Testament, who, you know, very often are externally standard will-oriented people, but clearly they are not seeking after the righteousness of God. They've completely abandoned that for their own righteousness. So I will say that self-righteousness and God's righteousness, those are kind of the only options. And your version of self-righteousness, I mean, you know, you have your own standard. With all the virtue signaling and other things that are going on in society right now, you can see that even people who have escaped fundamentalism in name haven't really escaped the spirit of fundamentalism oftentimes, because they're just as much pharisaical for their new religion as they used to be for their old religion. That's just the same spirit of desiring to seek after a righteousness that you can call your own, that you have control over. And that is definitely a disorder of the will. Anytime the goal of your will becomes self-righteousness rather than the righteousness of God, you have an abuse. And interestingly, that abuse requires an abuse of the intellect. So self-righteousness requires an abuse of the intellect, or you could say an abuse of the prophetic voice. Because the only way that you can actually determine that you actually are self-righteous, that you are righteous on your own terms, is by denying all sorts of evidences to the contrary and by suppressing the truth in unrighteousness, as it says in Romans. So unrighteousness or self-righteousness always requires a suppression of the truth. This means that most people who are seeking after self-righteousness actually need to be open to the prophetic voices in their lives, both the internal conscience — they may have calloused, but there's probably still a little voice in there that says, actually, you're not righteous, and they need to listen to that voice. And there's also, I'm sure, tons of people around them who find their behavior to be most repugnant and unhelpful. And they also probably say, hey, I don't think you're actually doing the right thing. You're being a real jerk, or, you know, you're being really selfish, or any of these kinds of things. And they should be open to listening to that. And that's probably the central issue with disorders of the will when it comes to the goal, is that there is a move towards self-righteousness that needs to be addressed, usually by a submission to the intellect. If you are willing to listen to the truth, almost always that's going to puncture self-righteousness and at least drive you to desperation and say, hey, I'm despairing of my own righteousness and I need to seek after God. The secondary disorder would be in the standard. Now, again, the standard should be the law of God. Everybody needs a law. Anybody with a will needs some kind of a law or set of rules. And so if you have a disorder in the standard, it's because you have adopted a lesser law than the law of God, whether through autonomy or what I like to call antinomy. So autonomy means that you've made a law unto yourself, meaning that you are not willing to submit to the law of God or to the rightful authority of other people. Antinomy is more a rejection of all law altogether, a certain kind of libertinism. Autonomy is usually connected to some form of self-righteousness, whereas antinomy is more connected to like sinners, just people who reject law altogether and aren't willing to be governed. But in both cases, you have either sought a law unto yourself that you follow slavishly, usually under the service of some kind of self-righteousness, or antinomy, which usually occurs because the will is actually being abused, meaning that the idea of following the rules is being rejected altogether. So antinomy normally happens when the will is in a subservient position, possibly the subject power, whereas autonomy usually doesn't occur unless the will is in a partner power at least, or even the leader power. So autonomy being a law unto yourself usually happens when the will is in the leader or partner power. And antinomy, meaning the rejection of all law and the idea that following the rules is not even a good thing to do at all, and that there needs to be this liberty to just do whatever you will, do whatever you desire, really, is usually happening because the will is being abused. The will is being put in a, is usually in the subject power position and is not being listened to or being strengthened. In the third failure or disorder of the will, having to do with the function of the will, we talked before about how the function of the will is supposed to be, the main function is supposed to be patience. The issue of patience is about standing your ground, and it's about not being aggressive in the distribution of impermissible evils toward other people in order to accomplish your own purposes. That would be the way of evil. So the way of evil is a rejection of patience, because you're using evils, meaning harms or withdrawals or deprivations of other people, in order to try to control and manipulate circumstances in order to get the things that you will, the things that you desire. But patience is also not passivity. So that is the other side of it. And I'll read you a proverb that addresses this directly. But Proverbs 17, verse 19 says, "He who loves transgression loves strife." So transgression meaning crossing boundaries. And then the second part of that verse is, "He who raises his door seeks destruction." You might say, well, I don't even know what that means. Well, to raise your door is to invite or open yourself up to any passing spirit or any passing power to basically come in and do whatever they will. So it is not good to lift up your door and just say, hey, anybody who wants to come in, come in. That would be passivity. That would be allowing anybody to cross boundaries. So a boundary is good, and patience is not passivity in the sense of patience doesn't require that you allow anybody to cross boundaries. Patience does set boundaries. The will is supposed to stand firm, not shrinking back, not being aggressive, but holding ground and standing firm. And that is the main function of the will. So if there's a disorder of the will in the function of patience, it's usually either from aggression or passivity. And again, like we talked about before, the aggression of the will usually happens when the will is your primary or partner power. The passivity of the will usually occurs as a weakness when the will is your subject power, or at least your partner power, but usually your subject power. So if it's your subject power, you tend to not have a strong will relative to your own capacities, and you probably don't have a terribly strong will relative to the capacities of will of those people around you. So you find it difficult to stand your ground, and other people are constantly running over you or trampling over you. And strengthening your will to hold your ground and set proper boundaries is oftentimes necessary. A lot of passive people tend to attract, as you might imagine, aggressive people. And those aggressive people don't even know what damages they're doing to those passive people. So setting proper boundaries is necessary, and patience is neither aggression or passivity. And that's really important. So if you have a disorder where your will is really strong and you tend to domineer other people, then you need to pull back and exercise patience and allow other people to come to their own conclusions and not coerce them. If you have a failure of patience in the sense of passivity, where you're being trampled over and you're basically a doormat, you need to bow up a little bit and set some proper boundaries and tell people straightforwardly and communicate straightforwardly the things that you actually want or need. And again, give them the freedom to come to those conclusions, but don't just avoid conflict simply because you don't feel like you're going to win it, and then use craft, deception, or other means in order to try and get what you want behind the scenes. That is not honorable, and it's not operating in the power of the will. So even if your will is subject power, invest in it if it's weak in order to raise up its strength so that you can set proper boundaries. And if your will is really, really strong and you find yourself overrunning other people, pull back a little bit, learn to set boundaries for yourself that you don't cross over in order to give other people the space that they need in order to exercise their particular powers. So I hope that helps. I hope that was a good overview. I know there's always a lot to talk about when it comes to these things. If you have any questions, please just ask. I would love to hear any of the questions that you guys have. I am here to do everything I can to try to use my gifts for your benefit. So God bless you. Happy belated Thanksgiving. And until next time.
I am a human being. Nothing human can be alien to me.